Hey folks, welcome to another exciting episode of Long Shots. I am here with Mr. Sharad Tupran. Hey Sharad, how's it going, man?
It's going good. I'm excited for today's chat.
Absolutely. So it gives me great pleasure actually to welcome Mr. Ravi Kaushik, partner at Waterbridge Ventures. I think he's been dabbling in the VC space. I won't say dabbling, actually. Mm-hmm. That's been like more than 4 years, right?
Yes, yeah. 4 years.
And he obviously, so Waterbridge Ventures is a venture capital fund, as the name sounds. Around, I'm kind of, our research is very cutting edge, so we've gone through your website and LinkedIn profile.
Of course.
So if there are any numbers which are dated, do obviously feel free to correct us. I think we've gone through 18 investments now, Waterbridge.
Yeah, exactly 18.
Yeah, yeah, and around 250 million raised. Ravi obviously has been, you know, sitting on the boards of Ziploan and Let's MD. I think those are the investments that you personally steered.
A few more.
I think there are two more, I think, that I recall. And earlier, I think Ravi was in DEG, which is a German investment firm. I guess the development finance.
Correct.
Kind of leaning, and at that time he was obviously, you know, sitting on the advisory board of various funds. And what's exciting to have, you know, to kind of have Ravi here is that, as per again the bio on the site, he's inherently excited by India's consumer opportunity, and he's interested in anything that passes the toothbrush test. So I was like, that's going to be my first question here.
Yeah,
that what do you mean by the toothbrush test?
Once a day, every day, or twice a day, every day, or whatever it is. But yeah.
Sure. So firstly, guys, thank you for having me over. It's really exciting. It's a pleasure. Also happens to be my first podcast, so thank you for that. Okay, so I think, first of all, I didn't come up with a toothbrush test. But right. I think, as the name suggests, right, I think it's anything that requires repeat usage. Right. One of the single biggest things we look for in consumer tech opportunities is, why should people come back and use the product? Why should they come back and use the service?
Right.
And if you have figured out that holy grail where people are coming back on a daily basis, that's probably the biggest sign for this product market.
Something which is need to have rather than good to have.
Precisely, precisely. A need to have, like you read newspaper most days of the day, of the week. You consume water multiple times a day.
Right.
Something which compels you to go back and have a look at that. And
right.
And we can talk about this later, but Chalo, one of our investments, actually passes the toothbrush test.
Right.
What Chalo does is it gives the user, let's say someone is taking an intra-city bus.
Right.
Chalo targets 300 million people in India who use the intra-city bus in India, the local bus.
Mm-hmm.
People go to bus in the morning from home to work and back in the evening. Chalo is creates solving that problem where they have no clue on a bus stop which bus comes when
right.
and where it's headed. So the idea there is, if I'm at home 15 minutes before, I check the app, I know it's coming in 15 minutes, accordingly planned, and the same cycle repeats in the evening. So that's a good example of what we think could pass a toothbrush test.
Right. But like, Ravi, it's interesting, like in terms of, like you don't come from a vanilla VC background.
Right.
You kind of, I think, took a, I mean, finance is something common, obviously.
Yeah.
Finance, fund management,
correct.
Investment advisory is the common thread. But then you kind of, you know, stepped into venture capital, which I think in our country, still a lot of people struggle to
yes.
understand the dynamic of it. How did you kind of end up in this space?
Sure.
How did the journey start?
It's an interesting journey, because I never thought I would end up in venture capital. I think I went to business school in 2007. I went to Thunderbird in Arizona State. I graduated 6 months after Lehman Brothers, Indian male engineer trying to switch to finance.
Right.
but I knew very clearly at that time that investment was my calling.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I wanted to be, at that time, private equity.
Right.
Had to spend about a year at Ernst & Young doing
yeah.
investment banking.
Right.
When I came back to India, cut my teeth in financial modeling,
mm-hmm.
Indian financial services, and just business in general.
Right.
And had interned with Aquarius when I was at
right.
Business school, and when they were opening to look into hire, that's when I joined them. I think six odd years in private equity.
Mm.
I think the venture capital happened by chance.
Right.
I knew Manish, who was the founder of Waterbridge Ventures from before.
Right.
And I was contemplating what next from DEG at the time. And I met him and I said, listen, I'm starting this fund. Why don't you join? So passionate about technology, engineer at heart, love investing. The fundamental principles of investing stay the same, whether it's private equity or venture capital. You're looking for the bigger ones, the market size, the founder quality, corporate
right.
governance, key differentiation, things like that. The principle investing stays the same. Of course, the nuances of private equity are very different
yeah.
from venture capital. But that's how I sort of landed up in VC. It's been now 4 years and enormous learning. Absolutely love the journey.
Mm.
And I think that sort of has been my...
Do you see something very specific to the Indian ecosystem when you come to the BC world, right? I mean, there are some salient features that you think are very unique to India when you view them from a VC lens, or you think, you know, it's almost the same, like the fundamentals of investing, like you said, is just like, you know, growth and get a better exit. I mean, it's very exit and driven, right? In the West, like, is that the same narrative here as well?
Yes and no, right? I mean, if you contrast private equity with venture capital, I think the single biggest difference is how fast venture capital moves. You have to be abreast with so many things happening, not just in India, but across the globe, which may not be necessarily true for private equity.
Right.
The volume of companies you meet, I think the last 4 years, I have met over 1,000 companies.
Oh, wow.
While in private equity, you probably do one deal a year. Or one deal in 2 years.
Right.
I think the second one. I think the third one is just being open-minded. And I think that's probably the hardest thing in venture capital, because you always have your biases. When you spend 8-10 years in investing, you have a certain bias on a certain sector, on certain kind of businesses.
Mm.
But VC is all about disrupting existing models.
Right.
So to walk in with every single meeting with an open mind, incredibly different from perhaps in private equity.
There must have been like some sort of transition window, right? I mean, like me and Sharad, like he comes from an equity research leading, like
right.
a woman M&A, investment banking leading, and then we kind of got into the entrepreneurial world.
Right.
We very quickly realized that, you know, the structure that you take for granted in a big or more formalized setup, that kind of disappears, and it's more about agility. It's more about, you know, throwing darts in potentially the right directions.
Yes.
And I guess from an investor standpoint, that must be also a different dynamic, right? In a PE side, you must be looking at, I would say, you know, with some companies with a fair bit of track record,
right.
cash generation, there's
yeah.
a model which has already been tested in some
yeah.
way or the other. Whereas in VC space, you might often be, you know, you don't even know whether that sector exists.
Correct.
And that's
yeah.
something that will come, you know, maybe a year later, and you're supposed to read
yeah.
those
yeah.
things. In advance, right?
Yeah.
Was that the exciting? Was that something that and in addition to that, it's I think more people oriented,
yes.
right? I mean,
No, great question and spot on, right? I think having spent 6 years in investing before I came to VC, I was very clear that things would look incredibly rosy when I first get into VC, because it's
right.
exciting, it's young founders,
yeah.
it's tech, I'm
yeah.
going to disrupt the whole world.
Right.
So what I was very conscious is that I told myself that first 6 months, I will simply meet companies.
Right.
I wouldn't make any investment.
Mm-hmm.
I think that was me testing myself in the waters, making sure that I don't get rosy-eyed for the first company I meet. I need to be at least a few hundred companies old
right.
before I can say, okay, this one makes sense, and this
right.
was where we should back our money on. And that's exactly what I did. I think I joined in June of 16. I didn't make my first investment till December
right.
of that year. So it's very clear that take your time, meet enough companies so you know what really is going on in the landscape. I think the second one was also to network with some of the VCs.
Mm.
I knew some of them from before, but some of them are new. But just to see what are they excited about, what is, let's say, trending in the VC ecosystem.
Right.
Because I think that's also quite critical to what we do and how we see the world in our view.
Like in sort of, you know, living in Canada for almost 8 years, there used to be this famous quote by, you know, their hockey
right.
player Wayne Gretzky, used to say, and a lot of bankers and VC guys used to use it, like, don't chase the puck, chase where the puck is going to be
right.
in the next 2 seconds, right? So,
precisely.
And like in, like, you know, Nikhil was talking about structures in place at a banking world, you always had precedent transactions.
Yeah.
In sort of VC space, you probably rarely get precedent transactions if you're actually looking for some new market to come up, right?
Yeah, yeah.
That is probably a big challenge, right? I mean,
right.
how do you, like, we often think, like, if you look at a new business, how do you value it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a question that keeps coming up, right?
Okay.
If there's no free cash flow generation or
yeah.
there's, like,
yeah.
those are the things that you, I guess, you discover new methods, right? And move
correct.
Away from the textbook.
Correct. Two questions. I think one was around valuation, which I'll come
yeah.
to in a bit. I think the second one was more around how do you sort of know where the puck is going?
Yeah.
I think because we have all the partners at Waterbridge have spent their teeth, cut their teeth in private equity, angel investing in India.
Mm-hmm.
Our big focus is tech disruption in Indian economy. I think Indian economy, multiple sectors, multiple sub verticals are all, each of them a few billion dollars in size.
Yeah.
And several of them are ripe for disruption, which means that I think our big focus is not just tech, but is there a real need for what you're doing? How is tech not just disrupting, but also is helping you scale? And because we have a fairly good understanding of the underlying fundamentals of the sector and the subsector, I think that gives us a better understanding of what these guys are trying to do. Right? So that is one. And the second one is just being aware, really, of where the trends are.
Mm-hmm.
I think in VC, a lot of times you see similar models in US and China, of course.
Mm.
And we look to those markets to see what has happened, what has worked, what has not worked, what are the lessons that we can learn, and why do we believe, not the same model, but a variant of that model should work in India. And that's critical part of what we do as part of our investment sort of thesis when we look at any company or any thesis. In terms of valuation, I think it's a lot simpler. I think private equity was a lot of financial modeling, PE ratios, EV/EBITDA ratios, financial engineering, if I may. Here is actually a function of dilution. This is the company, that's the stage, this is the capital that we are going to invest in. We are obviously aware of not diluting the founders too much. At the same time, we also want to have a meaningful stake for ourselves. So here it's really a function of dilution. I think valuations start becoming meaningful metrics, Series B.
So here it's more like transaction, like the transaction pricing rather than the value in the early stage. Is that how you
Yeah, I think in the seed to Series A space, it's a lot more about dilution and how much capital the company really needs versus what value do I put? Because like you rightly said, a lot of times it's no revenues or early revenues. Of course, it's cash flow negative. But that's not what we're investing in. We're investing in the future. We're investing in the founder's ability to scale and take us into the future that we share the vision with them.
It's interesting because like I'm pretty sure whenever you meet a founder or team of founders or whatever, they will put the best foot forward when they're meeting you, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they would always say the right, correct thing which you would like to hear, you know, because I mean, they always know that you are looking at them potentially from that perspective and it goes both ways, correct?
Right.
How do you break through that veneer of, you know, because I think that's a major role, you know, right, in terms of how much you like the team, how you like the, you know, people who are working on
perception.
So, I mean, because there's no immediate, I would say, return expectation.
Correct.
Right. So, is it just a function of spending more and more time with people you think are going in the right direction, or are there any tricks of the trade that you have learned all over the time? Probably this is not the best platform to say that, but I mean, any case, is there something that can, you know, share just to get the psyche behind how you operate?
Mind or in psychology somewhere.
There's no tricks to the trade, right? Yeah. I think there are a few things that we look for in founders, right? I think that's where the question is really coming from, and also to sort of break that veneer. Founders have to sell, and any startup founder has to sell at all times. He has to sell to consumers, he has to sell to partners, he has to sell to investors.
Mm-hmm.
So we get that.
Yeah.
In fact, part of our investment validation is how good a seller is the founder, because he has to sell. He has to sell to the next venture capital if he has to raise more capital. Right? But I think one of the biggest things we look for is opportunity cost. What is the founder giving up to do this? And I think that's critical, because that really defines, is the founder willing to sweat, blood, and everything that he has to make this a success versus it's fashionable to do a startup right now. Capital is perhaps easy at this point in time, and hence let's do this. And that's a very critical piece of our evaluation.
Skin in the game.
Skin in the game.
Right.
I think the second one is, because I think most founders that we invest in are high quality guys who can get any job that they want.
Yeah.
It'll take a few months, but they will get that job. Yeah. Right. So what are they really giving up?
Right.
Why are they passionate about this?
Right.
I think the second one is, like you rightly said, multiple interactions. Right? And it's actually a very important test, because when we meet the founders multiple times, we try and walk away with a sense that, am I impressed with him or her every single time?
Right.
Or is it that after the second or third meeting, there wasn't anything new?
Right.
It doesn't mean founders have to say new thing every time. It's just that as the interactions get more richer, am I learning new things, and am I impressed with the founders every single time?
Right.
I think the third one is just experience. I think that's something that you learn from some of your senior partners in the firm, something that you learn with experience.
Mm.
When you meet a few thousand people from founders, you start developing that instinct, which can be a bane and a blessing, because you don't want to pigeonhole
also.
Exactly.
Doesn't work.
But at the same time, you also lean on that experience, because at the end of the day, all things said and done, the stage that we come in, it comes down to the founders.
Yeah.
They have to execute. The market might be huge, the product might be great, but they have to execute.
Right.
So you have to believe in the founders. You have to like them. It's like a marriage. It's like a marriage with an exit clause, but it's a marriage.
Right.
And you have to love them to do this business.
Right. It's exactly like a marriage then.
Yeah.
That is an exit clause.
Well, marriage doesn't have an exit clause in most cases.
we can go into like grim humor. Yeah. Anyways. No, but I mean, you also kind of, you know, alluded to like India has many markets which are $1 billion quantum each,
right?
There are like sectors, subsectors, spaces.
Yes.
And that's something that, you know, one kind of, like obviously you know, you would look at it things from like a 10x, 20x, 100x perspective.
Yeah.
But when we look at the Indian market, and now I'm like saying it more from a perspective of a kind of economy commentator.
Sure.
That one is that, oh, there's a 300 million person middle class, is a big, you know, kind of under-penetrated space,
right?
And there are lots of big startups,
yeah,
well-funded, which are kind of targeting that domain.
Correct.
And then over time, I think probably the first chain of Indian startups,
yes,
were all pretty much aiming for that cycle, right?
Yeah.
And then there was obviously a correction, right, in terms of the perception of the market. Okay, there are 300 million people.
Yes.
Let's look at, you know, their share of wallet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, are they really classified as middle class, quote unquote, by Western standards or by global standards? And then you kind of, you know, maybe in terms of, you know, share of wallet, that number might be something smaller, and then it becomes more of a margin play.
Correct.
Right? And that again is, you know, probably not the most interesting thing in the consumer space, but in the enterprise space, that might be more interesting, right?
Yeah.
So how do you kind of, I'm sure that kind of, you know, internal metric or framework,
yeah,
is all the time being refined in your mind, right? When you are seeing how the space is evolving, because I'm sure that when you speak with 1,000 founders,
yes,
very quickly you have to put them in some sort of a bucket, right?
Yeah.
How do you approach that, and what for you is the great Indian consumer opportunity?
Sure. Yeah. I think let's take a step back, right? Because,
yeah,
I think we have to put some fundamentals in place. The big tailwinds are, of course, we have said this before a million times, Jio has made data incredibly cheap.
Yeah.
India is now the second largest smartphone buyer in the world in terms of shipments.
Right.
I think we're the largest country to download apps in the world, if I'm not mistaken. I think we're at about 2,500 in China in terms of per capita income dollars. I think China saw a real explosion at about $4,000, and we're heading towards that.
Right.
So there are a lot of UPI payments, micro payments, video KYC are all massively changing in terms of the payment landscape. So massive tailwinds from that perspective.
Right.
But we also need to understand that India only has about 150 million people who actually buy online any kind of a service or a product, which means that pretty much every single company is actually going after that segment.
Yeah.
So we need to be very conscious of something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, right, I think most segments in India are a few multi-billion dollars,
mm-hmm,
but we spend enormous amounts of time just sizing the market in terms of what is your real addressable market?
Yeah.
What is your real obtainable market? Because that clearly defines, will a founder, will a company succeed or not?
Right.
Because you might have great product market fit, but a lot of times companies cap out in terms of how big can they become. So we spend enormous amounts of time on market sizing, because we have realized over time that, and I can tell you every single founder, the market slide is always a few billion dollars, which is true, but we'll have to sort of synthesize that. What are the filters?
Yeah.
Who's going to buy? Who won't buy? So on and so forth.
Right.
So we have to put that into context. Now, having said that, we are incredibly excited because these tailwinds are all pointing to a bunch of things.
Mm-hmm.
One is, the consumer opportunity is increasing. We have seen a plethora of a variety of brands in segments, small segments that are online first, online only, omni-channel coming up.
Right.
Because people are wanting to buy. They want a differentiated product. They want a differentiated service.
Right.
So that opportunity exists, and that's actually going to only increase going forward.
Mm.
We also have to take a step back and see, where are Indians spending most of their money on?
Yeah.
And most of the money goes in two or three pockets. There's health for them and their families.
Mm-hmm.
There's education for their children, which is a massive opportunity. There's housing,
right?
And everything sort of comes after that.
Yeah.
Right? So we have to put these lenses every single time we evaluate an opportunity to see, is that really where the spend is going to go?
Mm-hmm.
Is it a discretionary spend? Is there a repeat? Will people come back and buy this product? Is it a one-time novelty? We'll have to put all of these factors in before we sort of said, okay, this is what we like.
So, you know, of late, like the narrative and sort of, again, economic angle is sort of a consumer slowdown, and we've seen FMCG and auto, like a big pictures, you know, the gloss has come off it in recent times, but obviously there's expectation of a reversal.
Right.
And like, you know, when you sort of break the market down into classes, lower middle class, upper class, in terms of paying capacity, I mean, I was just reading that the biggest growth is expected from, so as to speak, like rural sector, right? And they've broken down rural into two cohorts as well. Like, there's a lot of internal revenue or market potential or driving engine that the rural economy sort of expected to pick up, right?
Yeah.
Is there, do you think there's enough focus from a VC or from an entrepreneurial standpoint, or you're seeing investments go to that level? Or do you think, because I don't know how you square off the toothbrush test with that market.
Like,
that's sort of, what are your thoughts on that?
No, great question. And I think we actually think it's a misconception that there isn't enough spending in the rural. There is massive volume. The tickets might be small, but there is massive volume. So there are massive spends in the rural.
Right.
And in fact, we have a company called MedCords. which is in the rural healthcare space. They digitize prescriptions and then they become the single point of contact for rural healthcare in terms of doctors, in terms of primary healthcare, so on and so forth. So we actually believe that rural healthcare spends are massive.
Mm-hmm.
The key there is you need to figure out your go-to-market. Yeah. You need to figure out what is your strategy to hit a very large number of subscribers or users fairly quickly. Because then even if your per average ticket is small, you have volumes and hence it can start becoming meaningful. Right? We believe that's the key in rural. Because if you don't figure out your go-to-market, and again, tech adoption is obviously much lesser in rural versus... So you have to innovate on tech. You need to figure out how do you go after these rural consumers, how do you stay engaged, and how do you give them value.
Right.
Because the spend is there.
Yeah.
But it is about a volume game, at least for now in the rural space.
But you know, like their entire focus on addressable market rather than just what the market slide says.
Yeah.
Was there a point in time when, like from your internal process perspective, there was a realization that, okay, we need to look at that, or this is something that you kind of put very close to your chest from day one? Like you guys were like pretty clear on that front. Like, was there some sort of a observed trend that kind of acted as some sort of a mechanism to see that, okay, no, like just because, you know, there is a 150 million number, that's not the complete picture, right? There must have been some precedent you know, one can kind of see analysis perspective.
Correct.
Or was that the thesis from day one?
No, I think it's obviously it's a learning journey, right? Like you start figuring out over time as to how else do you get smarter about slicing and dicing your addressable market. What is the ability to spend, willingness to spend, and also a lot of time spent on just primary research. Right? You can read every single report in the country on everything that is to be there, but there's nothing better than primary research. And we actually spend a lot of time, especially when we are a little bit deeper in a certain opportunity, to do a lot of primary research, because that's where the real answers lie. And we try and be as objective in our questions, removing biases, so we get to the right answers. So it has been a journey. There hasn't, like, we can't claim that we were day one, we were razor sharp on that. It's obviously a journey.
From primary research, I just recall, like you were mentioning, right, when you used to cover telecom stocks, that you used to actually talk to retailers about devices, that what is going on.
We were a top rank. I worked with a top ranked analyst, and once every quarter before like earnings, I used to actually go down and we used to chat and see like, oh, what sims are being sold more, or what subsidies, or any plans coming.
Absolutely.
And they're like, I mean, Canadian market is just three players and they all have equal market share. So it's just, but I mean, that's sort of the cornerstone of research, right?
And I can tell you, a lot of times we have passed on the opportunity because the validation didn't come from on-the-ground research. Right. So we have to get out of our comfortable offices and go out there and get the real answers.
Right. Now, like, obviously, there has been a wave of, like, I was reading, I think recently only, like, it's, I think, first month of 2020, there have already been, like, around 18 big investments on the startup space. Like, you know, you keep on getting the alerts.
HDFC yesterday said that they want to dabble in the private investment space.
Right. Yeah. But, so there's obviously like a kind of a, that flow is going on.
Right.
But there's always a narrative of lack of meaningful exits.
Correct.
Right? In terms of IPOs.
Yeah.
This is one of our favorite topics with everyone, entrepreneurs and VCs. And we always jokingly always say that India's first and biggest unicorn is Reliance.
Right.
And then we lay the platform and then we talk about what the other companies are doing. Right. I mean,
So, like, I mean, in terms of like exits, you know, being from an IPO standpoint or a secondary sales standpoint, I mean, there's a bit which has happened.
Yeah.
But there's always that narrative, you know, and the idea is that the counter to that is this is just the first wave of companies which are now kind of closing.
Sure.
So, you know, we are fairly new to the entire ecosystem from a startup standpoint.
Right.
What's your kind of take on that? Like,
I'll answer that in two ways, right? Yeah. I think, first of all, you're absolutely right. I think exits is always an area of concern for us GPs and also for our LPs. And historically, you're right. I think both the private equity and the VC haven't sort of lived up to at least the Indian ecosystem in terms of what exits. Right? But we did some work on this and we sort of, let's put some real numbers out there and we can start slicing and dicing that.
Yeah.
I think in the 10-year period from 2008 to 2018, before 2008, I guess the VC wasn't as realistic. Mm-hmm. So let's say last 10 years, I think about $43 billion came into the Indian VC ecosystem as investments. 50% of that came in the last 2 years, which is 2017 and 2018, right? Which means that in terms of tenor and age, the same time period, from again the same 10-year period, about 23 or 24 billion has gone out as exits. Of course, Flipkart is a big piece of that, but almost 50-60% of that has gone out as exits, of which most of it happened in the 4 years, right, from the 2014 to 2018 period.
right?
The point I'm trying to make is most of the capital has come in with a 2 to 3 year vintage.
Yeah.
Exits are starting to happen,
yeah.
But the average age is still a 2 to 3 year horizon, which means that for meaningful exits to happen, you have to give it it's a long-term asset class. So you have to give it a 6, 7, 8 year time frame. That's number one.
Right? Yeah.
Second is, you're right. I don't think there's any VC exit from an IPO.
Yeah.
I think Equitas is a great example.
Yeah.
Where we had invested, and I know from start to IPO was 7-8 years.
Right.
Incredible story.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So few examples there, but classical VC, it hasn't happened.
Right.
Now, having said that, I think as an early stage venture capital firm, we are starting to see meaningful exits starting to happen Series B, Series C onwards.
Right.
Right? For instance, in Fund 1, we exited Un Academy at the Series C stage.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Similarly, we're starting to see Series C, Series D investors say that let's start rationalizing the cap table, let's make it more consolidated, let's prepare the company for the next phase of growth, and let's give out exits to some of the early investors. And that takes about 3 years' time, sometimes 4 years' time.
Right.
So those exits are starting to come out. We also believe that to say today that every single company is going to become a unicorn is probably not a right way.
Yeah.
We actually think India has a $100 to $500 million type exits is a meaningful number to target in India. Because I think that's realistic. And as an early stage investor, you still make very high multiple even those kind of exits.
Yeah.
Right? Hopefully, you will have one of those $1 billion exits.
Sort of another thing, you know, an exit is one. Another thing is about how loss making some of these companies are,
sure.
right? And a big piece of them, about 25 odd unicorns that we have, I don't know what percentage of them actually make profits, right?
Right.
And which is normal. It's an early stage, like you said. What is the view that there will be a time when they'll start reversing it?
Right.
Are there moats built in those businesses which can actually help to monetize to the bottom line?
Right.
Or is it more of, let's see, I mean, I don't want to miss this bus
right.
and get caught offside. Rather, let me just take the plunge. I might as well be wrong with the whole world
sure.
rather than the only guy who missed the bus, right? I mean, because as of now, I mean, there's a lot of price-based moats that are developed and there's an argument, right? I mean, how sustainable they are.
Correct.
How do you sort of view that angle and, you know,
sure.
is margin preservation? Would you trade a point in margin for a point in growth, right?
Sure.
I mean,
sure.
that's sort of, what's the view around that?
My favorite answer to this is, if I remember, I think Amazon was loss making for the first 15 years of its existence, right?
Yeah.
Now, having said that, right, I think we don't believe in businesses which are scaling purely through discount. Consumer needs to be willing to pay for that service. And I think the focus is possibly now back on unit economics.
Right.
Yeah.
Where at the unit economics level, you either need to be profitable or I need to see a clear path to profit at CM1, CM2, whatever you want to define that as.
Right.
So I think that's very fundamental to what we look at. At the stage that we come in, sometimes our contribution margin positive, sometimes they're not, but I have a very clear understanding on what those levers are to get to that point. Now, it's anyone's guess how long it will take, because obviously it's not that straightforward, but at least we believe that there is a path to get there. Now, having said that, to answer your larger question, I think the VC ecosystem, a lot of time, especially in a country like India, is about market share, is about getting to the market, building that habit formation, so that over a period of time, you actually start making money. So a lot of time, it is about market share, right? Because if you're not growing at a fast pace, if you're not relevant to the ecosystem, nobody's excited about you.
Sure.
Right? You can have a great business for the family, which is great for you, cash flow generating. But if you want to scale and if you want to hit a meaningful scale, you have to be meaningful in the ecosystem.
Right? Yeah.
So a lot of times it is about market share.
Right.
And I don't think that's going to go away anywhere.
Yeah.
But it has to be married with macro, with microeconomic for any business to succeed.
But like one is looking at that narrative as an observer, right? One is actually taking a bet on that narrative. I mean, what's your take on that in terms of like, would you rather go for the unit economics positive or clear path to monetization view? Or would you go for grab the market share, become relevant, and then
figure it out
at critical scale?
Yeah.
Then you obviously price up and make money.
Sure. I think I can give you an example. So we invested in a company called Business, formerly called Shukran. They are in the B2B e-commerce. I don't know, when we invested, they weren't contribution margin positive, but now they are.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And we could see a path to becoming that becoming contribution margin positive, and it's not driven by discounts.
Right.
We're quite clear on the fundamentals of that business.
Right.
But at the same time, we also need to remember that it's also a function of the investment environment. If there is capital available, then you actually want to focus on growth, and perhaps you can wait for contribution margin becoming positive for a bit. But if capital isn't that easily available, and of course, capitals go through cycles, right? Then the business model must have enough levers to tweak, to say that, you know what, I'm going to grow market share, but I'm going to calibrate that growth because I also have to take care of my cash.
But there's also risk in terms of when capital is available.
Right.
And like, let's say when growth becomes the core focus.
Yes.
I mean, basically from a founder perspective, from business perspective,
yes,
you, like I often feel that lack of capital becomes a very natural, kind of correction mechanism.
Absolutely.
For the entrepreneur,
yes,
to kind of find ways to make sure that the viability is there. But I think excess of it can spoil the model as well, right?
Correct.
I mean, that is something that we have also seen in a few
specific
cases without naming any names.
And we've seen that in big public companies as well, right? Access to cheap capital. I mean, investors seen it through, you know, it's been happening for a while.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. How do you...
No, it's a great question. I think one of the things that we do is before we make an investment, we spend a lot of time on to try and understand how much capital the company actually needs.
Right.
And we are very careful to give out that capital because founders might believe they need a certain amount of capital, but the moment you get into a deeper discussions on how much capital you really need, sometimes you actually come out with an answer which is much lower. But sometimes if it's a consumer brand, for an instance, whereas you need a little bit more capital for them to start becoming relevant. So we spend a lot of time understanding how much capital they need and only then decide how much we want to invest. And we're also careful in terms of usage of capital because if you don't do that, then you're absolutely right. Easy capital, then you just go crazy in growing the company without by forgetting the fundamentals.
Lots of front page ads.
Front page ads, perhaps the odd Lamborghini.
But like, you know, I just want to like take a bit of a segue towards policy environment, right?
Right.
I mean, like you mentioned about, you know, when you're talking about meaningful exits,
right.
And especially when you look at the IPO
right.
domain, I mean, like only recently, I think Indian companies being allowed to list overseas directly,
right. yeah.
that's a conversation which is not happening,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And I think a few months back, things like differential voting rights came into the picture.
Correct.
At the policy front, like as a VC, do you often like, guys, why don't you like, you know, there are models of policy which are already there in, in the developed world. Why don't you like just, you know, you don't have to reinvent the wheel. There's a lot of precedent on how things can be framed. Or do you, as part of the VC ecosystem, are you like involved in the stakeholder engagement with
right.
the government?
Right.
And B, how responsive do you feel the entire policy environment has been
right.
to date?
To industry, yeah.
I think to answer your question, I personally don't spend a lot of time on the policy. I think there are much more qualified folks from the VC ecosystem who
right.
are working with the government on
right.
policy. And I think I would, I feel like I don't need to spend my time there.
Right.
So is it frustrating sometimes? Yes.
Hmm.
But I guess you find a way to work in an environment which has been given to you. Right? Because there are some things that you can control and something that you can't control. And this is one of those things that you can't control.
Right.
So might as well spend a little time on that fretting and worrying about it.
Right.
So that sort of is how we think about it. Of course, we would like a better policy in terms of exits, in terms of now the smaller exchanges where you can list smaller companies at both BSE and NSE.
Right.
And also the fact that the whole capital gains issue around.
Yeah.
But I don't spend a lot of time fretting on policy because sometimes these are the cards that you're dealt with.
Right.
You just have to play with them.
Right.
But what that does is that it helps us not invest in companies where we feel there's a lot of regulatory angle to it.
Yeah. Okay.
There are companies which are operating.
That is in your control. So
yes, precisely.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
we know which companies have maximum impact from regulations.
Right.
We try and foresee what happens, especially
right.
in financial services.
Right.
If you have a lot of government clients. And generally, we'd stay away from companies which have a lot of government exposure.
Right.
Purely because it can change any time. If the government changes, suddenly our investment is at risk.
Right.
Shows up in the accounts receivable line item.
Indeed. Indeed. Correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And anything that you're probably looking out from the budget for the VC ecosystem? I mean, I know there are way more important things and such, but yeah, I mean... we'll see, but I guess it should become a priority somewhere or somewhere.
I mean, I'm just kind of interested more in the
income tax.
From the budget. I mean, I think what I would like bring out is probably from a thematic perspective.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which are the sectors?
Yeah.
Which are, you know, I mean, like if you look at the consumer space.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
We keep on discussing of how, you know, now lending is actually going up. Now, you know,
yeah.
index of industrial promotion is kind of on an uptick. Services PMI is on an uptick. So, I mean, I think a lot of times in the media ecosystem, there's too much cynicism in terms of, like, economies take a few quarters to, you know, kind
correct,
of
recover.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, before this budget, I think 18 months before this budget, we saw the supply metrics go down.
Go down, yeah.
Then we saw the demand metrics go down, right? I mean, no wonder, you know, when you look at the entire NPA domain kind of bursting, I mean, it will trickle down to the end consumer level.
Yeah.
But I'm fairly now optimistic about, you know, how the next 12 to 18 months will go.
Yeah.
And I would rather have the government not do a lot rather than do too much.
Yeah. I would say the single biggest thing would be to spur consumer demand.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Somehow figure a way to get more cash in the consumer's hands.
Right.
There's cutting taxes or increasing the ATC limits, anything which actually gives the consumer more cash.
Right. Yeah.
And hence spur demand.
Yeah.
I think that is probably the single biggest issue right now.
I think a lot of personal tax cut, I think, is being expected widely, and some of these stocks have also run up. But anyway, public markets are not as exciting as the private investment space. How about quickly and briefly, you walk us through it, just for the benefit of our users, how a typical VC deal, you know, closes. Like, you start by meeting someone, someone pitches to you. What is the next step? Like, just quickly, just to get for our listeners.
Sure. So, we at Waterbridge Ventures, since we are an Indian fund, we are domiciled in India, the investment committee sits in India, we can move fairly quickly on most investment decisions.
Right.
The typical process is, and I can tell you, most of the deals that we have done are founders that we have met through a reference.
Right.
A warm reference, someone from our network who knew, referred the founder. So that's number one. I think a typical deal is you meet multiple times, you understand the founder's motivations, what do they do, what are they doing, what they're doing, the horses for courses approach. Is he or she the right founder for what they're doing? We do our own both primary and secondary research on the market, consumers, competitors, the landscaping, our internal philosophy on some of these things. We obviously have a view and we have a certain liking for some sectors, some sectors we don't. The next step would be maybe after multiple interactions that we take it to our internal IC. If there is an agreement that we should go ahead, we give a term sheet. A term sheet outlines typical amounts, what are the broad legal terms, valuation, board seats, stuff like that.
Right.
I think post the term sheet, we do more commercial diligence. We continue to, the IC typically comes back with feedback on explore these areas of the opportunity. We do that. We also do a legal and a financial diligence on the company. For the stage we come in, it's not massive, but from a corporate governance perspective, it's incredibly important to us. So we do that, do a compliance check if all the laws of the land have been met with. Post that, we go back to the IC with our findings, the diligence and commercials and any other feedback points that had come back. And if we have satisfactory answers to everything, then the IC gives a go ahead. Then we get into documentation, which is the shareholders agreement, the share purchase agreement. We thrash those out. We sign the agreement, we transfer the money, and that's how a typical investment works.
And typically this process would be about 4 to 5 months, less than that?
No, I would say less. I think the VC ecosystem, you don't have 4 to 5 months on a deal.
Yeah.
Purely because it's fast moving.
Yeah.
A lot of, there's always competition, but because of our high value add approach with the founders, we work closely with our founders, and we have few investments. We don't make a lot of investments. Fund one was 16. Fund two again will be 15, 16 investments, 17 maybe. So based on that, we invest. I would say 6 to 8 weeks.
Okay, that's pretty quick.
If it's a real fast deal, assuming there are no issues on diligence, company's prepared with all the documentation, everything goes smooth.
Right.
I'd say that would be the typical time.
One thing that, like you mentioned, that obviously that you are India-based and that kind of gives you that agility.
Right.
But there's also this like interesting narrative, you know, in terms of domestic capital versus foreign capital.
Right.
And I think it was Mr. Narayan Murthy, I think he lately had a speech at Icon or something, right, in which he was saying that, oh, why don't we allow like pension funds, banks, insurance companies to actually start getting startup exposure, right? And this is something that actually, I also wrote on it, I think some year back or something, that I think like LIC manages around $300 billion
correct,
on its balance sheet, right? And it's all right now and fairly vanilla stuff. So even if, you know, one looks at like 1 or 2% of that, that's pretty much bigger than you know, like an annual flow which is coming in. But I like that narrative. But as soon as I see that narrative, I'm like, ah, banks, pension funds, and insurance companies who have been, you know, getting exposure to like government securities and stuff like that throughout their existence, are they even like skilled to look at this ecosystem, because I feel that when it comes to a state-driven approach in a country, then it's end-to-end. You know, they'll actually have some IS guy who'll probably head the fund or something like that, right?
Right.
And I mean, that this is an expert domain, right?
Correct.
And but what's your take on that?
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of capital, obviously it's a good thing.
Yeah.
But you know, in terms of execution.
Yeah. No, you're right. I think it's these are massive pools of capital, right?
Mm.
And we believe, and things have been changing, right? I think banks are allowed to invest a very small percentage in sort of alternative asset class.
I think
it's important that some of these asset classes start getting some exposure.
Right.
And I believe that it has to be done in a very calibrated way,
right,
where the fund manager or some whoever manages these pools of capital has to figure this percentage is an exposure to the alternative investment class.
Right.
And I think the way to do it is not direct exposure, of course,
right,
but to invest in funds. Because that way you are a step away from the actual underlying asset.
Right.
You're not trying to cherry pick companies.
Yeah,
relying,
funds rather.
You are relying on people who are supposed to be good at doing that, and hence that's where they should be. I think that's where it should be headed.
Right.
Of course, you have to be careful. It's public money.
Yeah.
But I feel like there are enough and more playbooks and models outside India that one can follow in a very calibrated approach.
Yeah, I guess it just takes time, right? It's a big ship to turn, especially with the risk profile, perceived risk profile that it carries, I guess.
But I guess as a fund of funds, that's probably
de-risks the narrative and scale. Yeah.
And I think SIDBI has been doing a fabulous job there
to
push government money to empower startups through their fund of funds program.
Right.
We are a beneficiary of that.
Right.
And I think SIDBI is doing a phenomenal job in empowering that money and pushing that capital onto actual startups.
Right.
What are some of the things that scare you from the ecosystem? Are there any concerns or red flags that you're like, you know, if that happens, that will be really disastrous for the ecosystem? Or, you know, things are fine, like, you know, we keep evolving and finding ways? Or is there something that keeps you up at night, as they say?
I think what keeps me up at night is missing the next big thing.
Yeah,
I think as every VC fund manager, I guess, is missing the next big thing, and that's what keeps me up at night. But in terms of what worries me, I think macro factors will always worry you, because it's a global economy. There are so many macro headwinds that keep coming at a variety of points in time. I think last year was worrisome because of what happened with Uber, what happened with WeWork, and the ensuing chaos that happened.
Right.
But I actually believe it's the right thing, because if it was a market with it was a frothy market, then investors would have invested blindly into what was promised for the future.
Yeah.
But actually, what happened with WeWork was the fact that investors asked very critical questions, which tells me that, yes, it's frothy, but at the same time, we're not blinded by the promise of a future.
Yeah.
There are enough and checks and balances.
Yeah.
Public markets have been very critical of businesses that don't throw up cash, which are not profitable, which don't see a view of getting profitable at any point in time. So that for me, actually was a silver lining. And I was quite positive with what happened.
I think that was also like the interface of, for the first time, there are a lot of venture-funded companies which are actually hitting the public markets, right, in bulk.
Yeah.
And probably that was like a test of the entire model.
Correct.
In terms of like, you know, having that viability in place before you actually hit the listed space.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think a lot of companies ended up trying to hit that threshold, but they were checked.
I think it wasn't necessarily the first time, but I think why WeWork took so much of headlines in India is because it is a consumer brand. Everyone knew WeWork. I mean, people may not know Slack outside of a certain community, at least in India.
Yeah.
But everyone knows WeWork. Right? It's a very prominent brand.
Yeah.
I have parents whose children are post-college working at WeWork.
Yeah, right.
So there was a real impact on people to say, what is going on?
Right.
Yeah.
I think that was the fundamental shift.
Right.
Otherwise, I think we are quite, the common man is quite clued out of what happens in the US markets,
right.
Especially a company listing.
Absolutely. I mean, awareness of Slack, it's more WhatsApp and phone calls here.
Correct. Precisely.
Email.
Slack is very enterprise focused. And that's one of the things Nikhil and I discussed when we came back again from our structured work in the West. It's everyone's email first, right? Here it's,
email.
I mean, I've had people send me Excel sheets on WhatsApp. Like,
correct.
And so it's a very mobile first. So I think you as an entrepreneur and as a VC as well, right? You have to sort of tilt towards a mobile first world. And it is, I think India is a mobile first, right? I mean, like there was an analogy that one of my friends was telling me, and he was talking to someone, Steve Power at Microsoft, and they were doing some research, and he was saying like the big finding was if you give an American $1,000, he'll she will buy a laptop. You give them a phone and you give them another $1,000. Right. They'll buy whatever they don't have. Their phone, they'll buy a laptop. They have a, in India, if you give $1,000, they'll buy a phone. If you give them $1,000, they'll buy another phone.
Indeed. So, indeed. So indeed. That sort of, yeah, I mean, on the Maslow's pyramid, we are quite low.
Yeah. Right.
But we have leapfrogged some of these things.
Right.
And
right.
The first port of call today is a mobile phone. In fact, a lot of the consumer loans is from mobile phones.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
have this strong aspirational need to buy a phone.
Yeah.
Smart, which is great, I think.
Yeah. And side effect is we just stop sending emails. We just call people. So
evolving.
We WhatsApp.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, and no, this is we're close to 50 minutes now, and
okay.
as promised, I mean this was a very very exciting chat. Time just flew, and it was great to have you.
Thank you.
No, I mean it was an absolute pleasure to have you and throw some insight on you know the kind of the psyche and the process which goes behind things from an investment perspective. I hope you also enjoy the conversation. And no, I think this was a good note to end this podcast.
Yeah.
What do you say? And I'd like to obviously remind all our listeners to search for Transfin Podcast, hit the subscribe button so that you get the nice little notification every time an episode goes live. And yeah, do share your feedback, your comments. And if anyone wants to come over, obviously give us a call us. Don't send a message on WhatsApp or email. And yeah, we'll definitely follow up on that. Thank you, everyone. This is Nikhil Arora.
This is Sharad Tupran.
Signing off.